Radiolab helps name a quasi-moon of Venus. This week on Planetary Radio. I'm Sarah Al-Ahmed of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Sometimes, misunderstandings can spark beautiful adventures. Today, we'll dive into a mix of serendipity and science as we explore the story behind the naming of Zeus Vae, a quasi-moon of Venus. Joining us is Latif Nasser, the co-host of Radiolab. He'll share how a typo on a space poster led the Radiolab team on an epic quest to convince the International Astronomical Union to name a space object. Then the great Bruce Betts, our chief scientist, will pop in for What's Up and a discussion of some of the things that asteroid hunters have found lurking in our solar system. If you love Planetary Radio and want to stay informed about the latest space discoveries, make sure you hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcasting platform. By subscribing, you'll never miss an episode filled with new and awe-inspiring ways to know the cosmos and our place within it. The motions of objects in our solar system, like any group of things that are dancing under the influence of gravity, are complicated. Our understanding of celestial movement has evolved dramatically since the early days of astronomy. At the heart of this evolution is Johannes Kepler. He was a 17th century German astronomer whose work fundamentally changed our understanding of how celestial bodies orbit. Kepler's first law revealed that orbits are not perfect circles, but are actually ellipses. This concept seems simple, but at the time it was truly revolutionary. Of course, the cosmic dance floor is far more complicated and crowded than Kepler ever knew. Beyond planets orbiting their stars in elliptical paths, our solar system is a bustling place. We have moons and rings and asteroids and comets, and they're all interacting under this dynamic ballet that's governed by gravity. This brings us to one of the more interesting performers in this dance, quasi-moons. Unlike moons that directly orbit their planets, or even mini-moons that are sometimes captured by a planet's gravity and orbit them temporarily, quasi-moons follow a seemingly more complex path. At first glance, they appear to orbit the planets themselves, but really, they orbit the sun. Quasi-moons are asteroids that share a very similar orbital path and period to the planets that they're associated with. The gravitational interactions between the quasi-moon, the sun, and the planet that they hang out with lead to this situation where the quasi-moon sometimes speeds up, pulling ahead of the planet in its path around the star, and sometimes slows down, which causes it to lag behind that world. From the planet's perspective, a quasi-moon seems to trace this really weird path, often described as a horseshoe orbit. But from the broader view, its path around the sun is precisely the kind of ellipse that Kepler described. I know it's a hard thing to visualize, so I'll put some resources on the webpage for this episode of Planetary Radio that'll help. You can find those at planetary.org/radio. Venus has no moons, but in 2002, an astronomer named Brian Skiff at Lowell Observatory in Arizona, USA, discovered an object that would later be understood as the first known quasi-moon of Venus. This object was initially given the temporary title 2002 VE68. But on February 5th, 2024, it got a much snappier name, Zeus Vae. That's all thanks to our friends at Radiolab, the scientists that they met along the way, and of course, the International Astronomical Union, or the IAU. Part of what the IAU does is give official names to objects in space. Radiolab is a podcast and radio show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. It's hosted by Lulu Miller and our next guest, Latif Nasser. Their show asks some really profound questions about everything from science to legal history, and uses investigative journalism to share the answers with their audience. Latif Nasser met me at Planetary Society headquarters to share this totally wacky but awesome story. Hi, Latif.
Hi.
Thanks for joining me at Planetary Society headquarters.
Are you kidding me? This is such a treat. It's an honor to be here.
And we're such fans of your show here. It's wonderful to have a podcast buddy in the house.
Oh, I feel like I'm totally starstruck being here. So thanks for having me.
When we heard your show about the Zeus Vae saga,
right,
we knew that we had to write an article about it, and people loved it. So I'm really happy to have you on the show to talk about it, because clearly this is one of the coolest, cute little space stories to come out in a while.
It's my honor. Did not see that coming when we were making it. Yeah, it's only after it came out that I'm like, oh, wow, huh, this is more people than just me care about this.
So how did this whole Zeus Vae naming saga begin?
Yeah, so it started a little over a year ago, something like that. I was putting my kid, my then 2-year-old, to bed. I was sort of putting him right in the crib. And I noticed sort of out of the corner of my eye that we had a solar system poster we had bought off of the internet. I kind of noticed out of the corner of my eye that Venus had a moon. And I was like, that's weird. Like, I didn't remember learning about that in school or anything. So I put my kid to bed. And then I was going to my bedroom and I just sort of Googled on my phone, does Venus have a moon? And the first result that came up was from NASA saying, no, Venus has no moons. And I was like, that's weird. And then the next morning when I got my kid up, I looked again and I was like, yeah, it's true. There's a moon on Venus on this poster. And the thing I hadn't noticed the night before, it had a name. And the name was this name, like Z-O-O-Z-V-E or Z-O-O-Z-V-E. And I was like, that's even weirder because I never heard of that name. So then I Googled that and then there was nothing in English. Nothing. How often do you Google something and there's nothing in English? At first, I almost was mad at first where I was, who's like giving my kid this? Who's like lying to my kid? Is this a prank? What kind of weird prank is this? The thought I had, I was like, either this is like a Pluto type situation where there was a thing and then it got demoted, or is this poster out of date in some way? Or the website that I saw from NASA, maybe that's out of date? Or the other thought I had was like, this is clearly a prank. This is the artist's dog's name or something, and they just sneaked it in. They thought no one would notice. All of this was weird enough and mysterious enough that I was like, okay, like now I have to find the answer.
Most people, when Google failed them, they'd probably just go, okay, it's a prank or whatever. But you had to take it to the next level and then did the logical thing, I guess, and called up one of your friends that worked at NASA.
Yeah, because I was like, who else would I call? Like, when did I buy this poster? Where did I buy this poster from? I couldn't even find that. And I was like, okay, it's just easier to call my friend Liz, having worked in the media department at NASA for a long time and having been a reporter even before that. Like, she's used to fielding calls from reporters. So I'm like, clearly, if this is a thing, she'll know what it is. Clearly, she would have gotten this question before somewhere from someone, which turned out not to be true.
But ultimately, she did figure out the answer.
She did. She was so good. So she, at first she said, no, I have no idea what you're talking about. I've never heard of this Zuzve. Venus doesn't have any moons. What are you talking about? And then she texted me and she was like, no, I figured it out. And it's not Zuzve or Zuzvi. It's 2002 VE, which is like sort of the format for how these, you know, near Earth objects and how these objects in general, these asteroids in our solar system get named. It's like an auto generated date stamp or something. Mm-hmm. So it got discovered in 2002 V. At first I was like, oh, VE, like Venus. And it's nope, not even that. V corresponds to a 2-week chunk of the year, like maybe it's in November or something. And then E, and it's actually 2002 VE68. So the E and the 68 refer to the order in which, in that 2-week window of 2002, that it was discovered. Anyway, very obscure naming protocol there. But when I talked to the illustrator, I asked him, I was like, what, is this what it is? 2008 VE? Is this your dog's name? Or what? Like, what is this? And he was like, no. So he like sort of outlined his process for me. And he has like multiple steps, including one where he like writes it out in pencil before he then transfers it to ink or whatever it is. And it's in one of those intermediary steps of his process, he, in his head, he had written 2002 VE, but then in his head he was like, no, it's clearly Zuzve. That makes more sense than clearly it being 2002 VE. So he just, it was a sort of a transcription error, but it was a kind of like a, it was almost like a typo kind of a thing. And it was like, almost as I was saying it, he was like, oh, that's the mistake I made.
It takes me right back to the early days of the internet where we used to use LeetSpeak to talk to each other with numbers.
Like, oh, yeah,
I think if
right.
I had stared at it long enough, I might have thought of that. But that is so funny and a weird moment that this accidental typo that ended up on a poster ends up ultimately contributing to the real name of this body. But you took it to a step even further. You called up the person, Brian Skiff, at Lowell Observatory that originally discovered this object to see if you could work with him to actually name this object Zuzve.
Yeah, well, the kind of funny thing about that is, so when I first heard from Liz, when she cracked the case, and she was like, okay, it's 2002 VE68, so I was like, great, tell me about 2002 VE68. And Liz was like, how would I know? I don't know anything about this thing. She just gave me the sort of briefest outline of what it is. And so I was like, okay, so now I need someone to explain what the heck this thing is. And in my head, I was like, okay, I'm going to go to the person who discovered it. Obviously, that person will know everything about it. And then when I tracked him down, Brian Skiff, who, what a genial, like, what a nice guy. And talk about someone who's like a star-crossed lover, someone who just like loves observing more than anything, and who's been doing it like every night and every weekend for, you know, decades. This guy, Brian Skiff at Lowell Observatory. So I asked him, and when my producer, Akedi, she emailed him, and when I first talked to him, I can't even tell you how anticlimactic it was. He was like, I was like, okay, 2002 VE68, what is this thing? And he's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't think I've ever heard of this. I'm like, I never heard of it. You discovered it. And he was like, oh, yeah, I guess, maybe. But what a flex, right? Like, how great a scientist do you have to be that someone finds something you discovered and you don't even remember it? But yeah, because he was part of this Lonios mission, which is, I guess, one of many of these missions that were funded by Congress to survey. They had some kind of a quota, like it was like 90% or 95% or something like that, of all the near-Earth objects, like around the time that, you know, Deep Impact and Armageddon came out, basically. But they would be discovering so many things in a single night that any one object, like, he just didn't know. They just found it. They would learn enough of it from either that first sighting or a second sighting to know that whether it was heading for Earth. And that was kind of the only thing they were interested in. And once they found out that it wasn't coming to hit us, it was like, okay, move on to the next thing, move on to the next thing, move on to the next thing. But for me, I mean, it was such a weird thing because I was like obsessed with this object. And I found the person who discovered it. It felt like, you know, the meeting the Wizard of Oz or something, getting all the way to the, you know, to the wizard. And then the wizard being like, I have no idea what you're talking about. It was very, very funny. Yeah, but then, so having even gone all that way, then I had to go sort of a few steps even further to find someone who actually did know what this thing was, who could tell me a little bit more about it. And that's when I met these two people. One is named Seppo Mikola in Finland, and one is named Paul Wiegert in Canada. And they also have other co-authors who worked with them, but both of them really knocked my socks off. They were the ones who really made me fall in love with this thing.
That's what's so interesting about space. It's like any subject you pick, literally any subject, you dive in a little deeper and it gets weirder and weirder and more interesting. And then you end up learning things like, this is a quasi-moon. And not just a quasi-moon, the first quasi-moon ever discovered.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I was like, what even is this? But Paul Wieger in particular, because he was the first one of them I talked to, he just sort of laid it out so clearly. And he was like, look, okay, everything in our solar system basically dances with one other thing, you know? Now, this thing is doing a kind of a different dance, and it's doing it further away than a regular moon would. And it's not just doing it with the planet. It's also doing the same. It's orbiting at the same time the star that the planet is orbiting. It's doing these two things simultaneously, and that it's even orbiting Venus. It's outside its sphere of influence. It's outside where a normal moon would be. It's sort of further away. And that this was a thing that had been hypothesized, that had been sort of dreamt up, you know, over 100 years ago, and that this was the first one anyone had ever found. That was so, I was like, whoa. Huh, this is like a whole new kind of thing.
Well, it's one of those things that you know conceptually exists, but trying to find an object like a quasi-moon, establish what it's going around, takes quite a bit of observation. So finding one like this just kind of opens the doors for everyone to find more. And since then, we've found several quasi-moons out around the solar system, including, I think, 7 of Earth.
That's it. You know, that's so astonishing to me that I don't know a lot, but I know enough about the history of astronomy to know that people have been looking up for a long long time, way longer than we've been alive, way longer than any of the fancy toys that we have now have been around. And you wonder the question, which is like, how did people not even see this until now, until the 2000s, you know? To me, part of it is a technological story. It's a story that it's like technology and the political will and the whatever, the money to say, okay, let's actually look what is actually around us. It's like, oh, look, there's a whole new thing that we didn't know whether it could actually exist or not. Now we know for sure. And now let's actually look for them. And oh, hold on. Now we're finding them. And we found another and we found another and we found another. Like, that's really cool.
So much has changed in the last few decades in our field. It's just going so incredibly fast. And I feel like we'll probably find a lot more quasi-moons in the coming years because although the NEO Surveyor mission, the Near Earth Object Surveyor spacecraft, has been delayed several times, the budget includes it. So NASA's budget does include this spacecraft going up, and we're going to get so much more information about what's going on up there. So this is just a Sarah prediction. I would say we'd probably find several more quasi-moons in the next coming decades.
Wow.
Right?
Amazing.
So who even knows what's out there?
Yeah. So much of why this is meaningful to me goes back to that map, that solar system poster that is on my kid's bedroom. That's the one we all learn about when we're in school. And in that poster, there's a lot of blank space. There's a lot where it's a very lonely place. This neighborhood we live in, it only has, I don't know what, 8 houses or something, you know? Like, it's a kind of a lonely place. And then to be like, oh, wait a second, there's all these other things here that are just not on the map. And they're weird and they kind of have their own kind of strange logic and they're just doing their own weird dance. There's all kinds of other stuff here.
Yeah, and every time you get closer to understanding more about them, the weirder they get. The closer you get to asteroids, the more you realize there's rubble pile asteroids and metallic asteroids that do things you can't even predict. Yeah. And they might have these weird little extra moonlets you didn't think were going to be
totally.
There. Or even in the outer solar system, we recently learned that the dwarf planets Eris and Makemake actually potentially have geothermal, hydrothermal processes going on them. They're way out there in the solar system. Yeah. So once we identify and find these things, then we take a closer look, and each time it reveals something new about the way that the universe works that we really weren't aware of.
It's so cool. I think especially, like, again, from the little I've learned about the history of astronomy, like, it's so cool that we get to live in a time where all these blockbuster discoveries are getting made, where you get to learn in real time, like as we're all learning them. They're not things you're learning in a textbook because someone figured it out 500 years ago. This is a thing that's like you're getting a push alert on your phone. It's pretty exciting.
We'll be right back with the rest of my interview with Latif Nasser after this short break.
Hi, this is Kate from the Planetary Society. How does space spark your creativity? We want to hear from you. Whether you make cosmic art, take photos through a telescope, write haikus about the planets, or invent space games for your family, really any creative activity that's space-related, we invite you to share it with us. You can add your work to our collection by emailing it to us at connect@planetary.org. That's connect@planetary.org. Thanks!
This is Casey Dreyer, the Chief of Space Policy here at the Planetary Society, inviting you to join me, my colleagues, and other members of the Planetary Society this April 28th and 29th in Washington, D.C. for our annual Day of Action. This is an opportunity for you to meet your members of Congress face-to-face and advocate for space science, for space exploration, and the search for life. Registration closes on April 15th, so do not delay. I so much hope to see you there at our Day of Action in Washington, D.C. this April 28th and 29th. Learn more at planetary.org/dayofaction.
It's cool, though, that people way back in the day had all of the basic understanding of the math and things like that that could have ultimately led them to this conclusion. Mm. As an example, in your shows, you were talking about the three-body problem, which was proposed fairly early on in physics, this idea that you can use two bodies orbiting each other, you can calculate out how that situation is going to go down. But if you put one more object in there, gravitationally bound to the others, and just let it play out, there's no way to predict how that thing is going to fall out. And the entirety of space is going through this strange dance. And They could have intuited that from the math back then, but it's not until we have all these people staring at the sky, finding this data, looking for these objects, that we can really go, oh my gosh, there it is. Here's this quasi-moon playing out this beautiful, intricate dance with all the other things in the universe around us that too are undergoing this strange dance with each other.
Yeah, and even at a time scale that seems very minute for everything else, but like even within a few hundred years, we don't know where this thing came from or where it's going. Like we can't tell you. I always, like in my imagination, everything is just, you know, again, from that map, right? From that poster, like everything's just doing its regular laps around. They're sort of speed skating around the rink over and over and over again. And that's sort of how you just picture everything. And they're like, no, there's just weirdos who are like doing their own weird improvised figure skating routine. Like it's so cool to be like, huh, didn't even think that was happening on this same ice rink. You know,
well, we don't have perfect understanding of everything. So, you know, maybe if you understood every object in the entire universe and had a supercomputer capable of calculating it, maybe then you could figure these things out. But this whole story just takes me right back to college, my first astrophysics class. I told you the story a little bit earlier.
No, I love it.
But in my class, one of my teachers actually, for the first homework assignment, assigned us a problem to solve the three-body problem. I spent 4 days trying to solve this thing, only to come back to class. A third of the class had dropped out at this point because it was impossible. And then we learned from the teacher, yes, in fact, it is impossible to solve this. I was just testing you.
Epic troll.
Although I will say, if I had just read a couple of pages further into the textbook, I would have found out that it was impossible to solve. So, you know, if you're studying, you hit an impossible problem, please just read the textbook a little further. It will save you some days of angst. So now we know that there's this quasi moon. Hmm. We've solved the mystery why it was named that on your poster. But why did you then take it to the next level? You wanted to see if you could go to the International Astronomical Union and make this an actual name.
Yeah, it just felt like this is the dumbest name. Why would anything be called 2002 VE68? And I was like, oh, this was this like auto-generated name. It's like a kind of almost like a license plate number or something. And I was like, oh, okay. But things do get named, but this thing isn't. But it has to be sort of a requisite amount of studied and documented to earn the right to have a name. It met that threshold. So it's nameable, but it just hasn't been named yet. And the person who theoretically has the naming privilege, they call it, is the guy who discovered it. The guy who, when I talked to him, Brian Skiff, not only has he already named dozens of things, he didn't even know he discovered this thing. I was like, okay, I don't think he kind of cares what it's going to be named. And then I had this kind of funny vision. If I was able to name this thing, or if we were able to name this thing, and if we were able to name this thing Zuzve, that retroactively makes the poster correct, actually. So I don't know. I thought that was so funny that I could somehow through this whole journey retcon, like fix the poster on my kid's wall. I got to do it. Like, we got to do this. And then that was the vision I had. And a whole bunch of the Radiolabbers who I was working with, Sarah Kari, Becca Bressler, Katie Foster Keys, Soren Wheeler, Pat Walters, Lulu Miller, obviously, a bunch of the other people I was working with, we all drank the same Kool-Aid, basically, and were like, Zuzve. It's got to be Zuzve. We got to name this thing Zuzve. So we enlisted Brian Skiff, and we enlisted the illustrator as well, and we put in, an official proposal.
Well, it's a beautiful example of how even a group of people who aren't like just steeped in space all the time, you get this moment to feel connected to the universe and feel like you can do something. And it mobilized the whole group of you to try to like go in on this.
Oh, yeah. And then also when we were putting out the episode, we had scheduled it such that we were like, OK, the name will definitely be in by the time we air this episode. Like we put in this proposal and we were like, OK, it's going to take a couple months. We budgeted a couple months, and then we had booked an interview with the secretary of this group, the Working Group for Small Body Nomenclature, to be like, okay, what's the final verdict? And that's what we were going to put right at the end of the episode. We were just waiting for that last puzzle piece to finish the whole thing and hit publish on the episode. And then he came back and he was like, jury's still out. We don't have enough votes. Sorry, I can't tell you yet. And so we were really bummed. We thought that everyone was going to hate the episode because it was like a non-ending.
It's a cliffhanger.
That's what ended up happening. It sort of flipped itself into a cliffhanger. And then I wrote about it on Twitter and did some TikToks and stuff. And like people got really, really, and through the podcast itself, people got really, really invested in it. Millions and millions of people just like just lost their minds over it. There were people who were like naming their pets Suzve. There were people who were like, yeah, there were just like all kinds of people who just like I was hearing about, you know, like in classrooms all over the world, kids were like, you know, talking to their classrooms about it and trying to get their classrooms excited about naming it and stuff like that. And so it was just, it was one of those things where I was like, oh, wow, like everybody got behind this absurd, I mean, it's kind of internet logic, right? Like, I guess it's in a way it's a version of Bodie McBoatface or something. But it was just one of those things where I was like, oh, like, kind of, it felt like the whole world wanted this typo to be like bronzed, you know, like etched in the heavens. And then that's what happened. Then we finally heard a few weeks later that was it. That it was for real. That Zuzve was going to be the name now and forever.
Congratulations! Excellent work. But also, how did the artist of this poster react when you let them know that this actually ended up and you had fixed the problem with the poster?
So his name's Alex Foster and he's from the UK. And when I first called him, I didn't tell him I was like, there's something on one of your posters that I think is really interesting. And I'm like, and I'd love to, I'm not going to tell you what, but let's get in the studio. And he was like, it's my New York City poster, right? And I'm like, no, it's not your map of New York City. So then finally we got to the bottom of that it was Zuzve. And he was kind of amused. And he was like, I don't know about astronomy. I just make posters. Like, I didn't make it up, but I don't know. I don't have citations for it. I don't know. You figure it out. And then by the time when we actually named it and I went back to him, I told him before, you know, it went public and everything. He was totally dumbfounded and stupefied, and he was so excited. And he then told me that even as an illustrator, he had never, ever considered getting a tattoo before of his work or anything like that. Because I'm an illustrator. I have, you know, I'm very critical of like images and stuff. And he's like, there's nothing, no image that I would ever love long enough that would justify a tattoo. And he's like, I think I'm going to get a Zuzve tattoo. So I haven't heard from him. He was like really seriously considering it. I don't know if he for sure got it or not, but he was really seriously considering it, which was, I found, a very high tribute, but also like kind of it was the journey he started. So it's his tattoo to get more than anyone else's.
I hope he does, because opportunities to name bodies in our solar system do not come by that often. And I understand that because of this adventure you've been through with the IAU, that you're working on a new project now to help more people name a new quasi-moon of Earth.
Yeah. So we just got, because it was so fun and it was so strange, this sort of little journey we went on and where we got obsessed with quasi-moons. And just nobody knew that quasi-moons, what they were, that they existed. I mean, I didn't before this whole little saga. And because we had just met all the people on the, you know, so we met the secretary of this naming committee. And I looked up, because Earth has all these quasi-moons, so I got interested in the Earth quasi-moons, and some of them have been named. But I was like, oh, but there's some here, again, that are in this kind of funny category of they are nameable but not yet named, so they're sort of up for grabs. And the people who discovered them as part of these similar big survey programs where like it's not really any one person who feels like they discovered it, and so you're not like taking those rights away from somebody. And besides, those objects have been sitting there and they could have been named until now and nobody named them, so they're just sort of sitting there. So we sort of broached the idea with Gareth Williams, who's that secretary of that nomenclature group. And he was like, yeah, maybe we could do that. Like, and they've partnered, they've done maybe even with you all before kind of like naming contests. And I was like, yeah, I think we could, like, we should do that. We should do that. And there are enough Radiolab fans all over the world. And it's also a public radio show. So it's like free. It's open to everybody. There's a lot of people who listen to our show in a lot of different places. And yeah, so we're like, this would be great. This was so fun that we got to do it. But in ours, we knew what the name was going to be. But let's do one where we don't know what the name is going to be. So we're going to solicit from anybody listening to this, if you have an idea for what you think an Earth quasi-moon should be called that has sort of mythological origins or connotations, send it to us. We really, really want to hear it. And there's going to be some sort of way for people to vote on those naming proposals. And then eventually we're going to have one. And that's going to be the name of this Earth quasi-moon, which feels even more sort of proximate to us and even more special to who we are and our sort of neighbors in this hood.
We've helped name a lot of spacecraft and places on other worlds and some worlds themselves over here at the Planetary Society. So I'm sure a lot of our listeners would love to participate in this. And how should they propose a name to your team?
I don't know yet, to be honest, because we're sort of taking our time. In the next few weeks to months, this will be, we'll announce on the Radiolab feed, and obviously we'll share with our friends like you.
That's so exciting, and I'm really glad that you're taking it to this next step, because what a funny, hilarious, and ultimately very meaningful arc for this story to go from a typo all the way to an opportunity for people to help us name a new world in our solar system. And there's so much of this story that we can't even get to in the show right now. So if people want to learn more about this, I'm going to put the links to all of the Radiolab episodes about Zuzve on this page of Planetary Radio so you can learn more about it. And hopefully in the future, when this naming contest actually becomes a real thing, I would love to have you back on so that everybody knows that now is the time and we can rally together to name this new world in our solar system.
My pleasure, Sarah. I live just around the corner. I'm happy. I'll come anytime.
Seriously, thank you for joining me and for sharing this story and for going totally extra and getting this name put on this world.
You know, what's life for if not going extra?
Thanks, Latif.
Thank you.
I know that we have a lot of Radiolab fans in our audience. When I told Planetary Society members in our member community app that I had spoken with Latif Nasser, the outpouring of love for Radiolab was truly beautiful. I promise we'll keep you updated on their upcoming contest to help name a quasi-moon of Earth. Now, let's check in with Dr. Bruce Betts, our chief scientist for What's Up. Hey, Bruce.
Hey, Sarah.
I love this story because it's a hilarious example of one of those moments when people just accidentally try to mispronounce one of our crazy number letter space names and then inadvertently end up naming an object in space. It's so funny.
No, it's very very funny, and I don't think there's a lot of precedent for it, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't think so. This is probably the first example of that. It's just, it's a really funny consequence of the fact that we give these really kind of obscure names to space objects.
Yeah. True, they sound obscure, but they're just cataloging numbers because so many objects are found that they just use a sequential system with the year and letters to designate the half month that it's found in and then which object in that month. So it ends up sounding weird, like 2002 VE68, but there's a very practical reason, since literally millions of objects have been found. And so having some way to name them before you know what the heck they are is useful.
What I love about this, too, is that this is actually kind of related to planetary defense, because they found this because they were looking for near-Earth objects. And ultimately, after looking at where it was going, they figured out that it was one of these quasi-moons in orbit around Venus, or rather, a quasi-moon that's in orbit around the sun, but appears to orbit around Venus because it's a quasi-moon in a horseshoe-shaped orbit. And none of that would have happened without all these efforts to protect our planet from near-Earth objects.
This is true, which is something that, as you know and listeners know, the Planetary Society finds very important. One of our three things that we focus on is planetary defense, meaning protecting the Earth from asteroid impact. And so, yeah, there are people looking, thankfully, and we need more looking and more other stuff, and we're working on it, and the world is working on it, and we're getting there slowly but surely.
Well, part of the way that we help out with this effort is something that you've championed really hard, which is our Shoemaker Near Earth Object Grant Program. What are some other cool discoveries that have been made through this grant program?
The grant program started in 1997, and at the time, there wasn't much in terms of professional surveys looking for these objects, so there were a lot of discoveries. But really, what we funded through the last couple decades were a lot of things focused to support the professional surveys that now exist. And so they instead of finding something, they may help determine that it's not one object, but it's a binary, or figure out exactly what its orbit is and whether that'll contribute to whether it'll hit Earth rather than the initial discovery. But we have been picking up more discoveries from our winners in the last 2 or 3 years, because we've got some great southern hemisphere locations that right now there's no consistent professional survey down there. So anyway, they've found everything from, if you go way back, they were one of the three discoverers of Apophis, which briefly held the highest probability of impact in a long time, but then with more observations was not, and will come by in 2029, closer than our communication satellites. Apophis, one of its discoverers was a Shoemaker-Neo grant winner. We had over 1 kilometer object discovered in the last 2 or 3 years by some of our winners in Brazil, and that's just unusual because those are the particularly terrifying global disaster objects, which fortunately we found over 90% of, but he still found one. And then also there was in 2013, there was an asteroid that eventually was named Duende that was found by a Spanish Shoemaker-Neo grant winner that we were watching it come by closer than our geostationary satellites, when within the same 24-hour period, completely unrelated, Chelyabinsk happened, and there was an impact of an object that no one saw coming out of the sun over Chelyabinsk, Russia. And so those are just a few that popped to mind, but I mean, there have been hundreds, many hundreds discovered by our winners, and many thousands, tens of thousands measured for their locations and their physical properties, thanks to the great work of these sort of amateurs that they don't get paid for, but they have amazing observatories, and we help them upgrade the observatories to get higher sensitivity or to have it robotic remote control operated, and basically do a great job supporting the professional surveys.
We were actually talking about that situation with Chelyabinsk and the other object coming in at the same time on a recent show with Dante Loretta, which right. I love that story because he was literally on the news his first time as a NASA official scientist talking to news agencies and telling them that they were totally safe, only to realize Chelyabinsk had happened that same day. And he kept reiterating, like, no, we're totally fine. They're like, no, we just saw it on the news.
No, we know it's not going to hit. Yeah, no, we had a video conference putting out over the internet with the guy in Spain who discovered it, and we're scrambling to figure out what the heck just happened with Chelyabinsk. And then of course there were the questions, were they related, and you'd think they would be statistically, but no, it was the statistical improbability because they were on totally different orbits, unrelated to each other.
This brings up another question for me that you just kind of pointed out earlier. We definitely have more coverage in the northern hemisphere looking for these objects than we do in the south. Why is that?
Because that's where they've built observatories that are dedicated to this. And, well, also the fact that you have something like 90% of the world's population is in the northern hemisphere. And so there's just less down there. But we've had Australia used to have some survey, but then they had issues, got closed down. Anyway, it's coming with what was LSST, the Vera Rubin telescope that'll be built down there and start being really operational in the next couple of years. We'll give one of the things that we'll do will be finding objects, looking for NEOs as well as a lot of other objects. But it's because that's where the observatories were, is the simple answer. So like the U.S. had observatories built largely in the U.S. and the U.S. has been the one funding the major surveys. And so the ESA, European Space Agency, has been getting more and more up to speed with European sites. So it's, you have to put your site somewhere else. So it was using the existing telescopes as the very long answer to your very short question.
But this just shows even more so the value of this grant program. I love everything that we do with all of our grants to people, but there is a real need for more coverage on this subject. And it makes me happy to know that we can help bolster people in the Southern Hemisphere that are trying to do this really important work.
Yeah, no, it's been great. And over the course of the program, we've awarded 70 grants, but they've been spread out in something like, I believe it's 21 countries on every continent, but Antarctica, we're still working on that. And it's been very successful. There are some really talented people willing to devote a lot of time, a lot of their own money, and we're able to give them that extra push to take what's already good observations and make them great observations that can try to keep up with the surveys or participate in things like studying binary asteroids.
Not all heroes wear capes, man. Some of them just use telescopes.
Actually, most of them wear capes also, but that's just a strange quirk.
We should start giving capes out to people who win our grants that say like Planetary Defender on them
or something. Gosh, that,
we should totally do that.
Well, we're getting you a cape first and you try it out and wear it around and then we'll see where we go.
Happy to help. So most of this episode, we talked about Zuzvay, this quasi-moon. As we said earlier, it's not like this object is actually orbiting Venus. It appears to do so, but it's actually orbiting the sun. But that means it's in this kind of like really unstable situation. What makes these quasi-moon orbits so unstable, and why do they eventually just kind of go flying off?
Rough family life growing up, usually.
Relatable.
Yeah. No, they're unstable because they don't have something that they're locked into a stable orbit. And so they get gravitational tugs from the other planets, from Earth, depending on where they are, even from Jupiter, but just other tugs that eventually will tweak their orbit and send them into a different orbit. And so if you're going around one thing, you're doing pretty well, but if you're in this awkward orbit going in and out in the solar system, yeah, you'll get by for a while, but I think these quasi-moons can be quite unstable in astronomical time sense, meaning tens, hundreds, or thousands of years doing that. I just wanted to point out, maybe it was discussed in your interview, but they often show plots of these objects and they look like they have these bizarre orbits because they put it in the frame of reference like a Venus in this case. So it bounces back and forth on the sky. But if you actually look at its orbit, it's like much less weird. It's a standard ellipse going around the sun and coming out past Venus. But it's got a period that's the same as, it goes around the sun in the same period as Venus's much more circular orbit. And so it always hangs out in the neighborhood of Venus because it's orbiting faster and slower because of the elliptical orbit, but in the end coming back around on the same amount of time. I don't know. That just helped me because sometimes I look at these and it's like, that's so bizarre. I don't do well with shifts in frame of reference despite the physics major background.
Well, it trips your brain out when you see it. I didn't really understand either until I literally watched videos on YouTube. So hopefully I can find some good examples of that to put on this page for this episode of Planetary Radio to get people understanding a little bit, because I know for me, these visual representations really help. Well, before we move on to your random space fact, I wanted to share this hilarious poem that came in on our member community by Gene Lewin, who's been submitting some really wonderful stuff recently. But in order to understand this poem, I have to share this story first. And this is one of the silliest space stories I've ever heard. So back in 1965, during the Gemini 3 mission, there are a few astronauts on there. John Young was one of them. And he smuggled a corned beef sandwich on board the spacecraft in his pocket. I think it was given to him by Wally Schirra, who is another astronaut, but who thought this was particularly hilarious. So he gave him this sandwich. And then while in space, he offered a bite of this sandwich to Gus Grissom. And I don't know if people like have really thought about this, but you take a bite of something in zero G, just crumbs fly everywhere. So when this sandwich incident happened, it ended up leading to a whole incident review from the United States House of Representatives Committee on Appropriations. And seriously, they had to make rules saying you cannot bring this kind of bread into space. And, you know, you'll notice people on the International Space Station still mostly use tortillas and stuff like that for this reason. So this is the corned beef sandwich by Gene Lewin. The Gemini program's hot cuisine, with entrees deemed quite bland, gave Wally Schirra the bright idea to provide delicious contraband. He had a special sandwich made by a deli near the site, but crumbs went flying all around once Grissom took a bite. This nosh raised quite a ruckus, a scandal it was called, resulting in preventative steps to keep control of what was hauled. Space travelers of the future may mimic the crew's style and try to eat a sandwich too, but it would have to be worthwhile. A cat's corned beef sandwich, now that would do the trick. But it would be really tough to hide, because that thing's 1 foot thick.
You just never know what will inspire great poetry.
But now I'm wondering, you know, what are the weirdest things people have snuck into space? I only recently learned that someone took wine with them to the moon during the Apollo era.
Yeah, Buzz did communion during his travels. So I assume it was him. He certainly brought the communion wafers.
Wow, that makes that story even more interesting. I'm going to be diving into that a little bit more in the future because we have someone who made a documentary about alcohol in space and all the things that happen with brewing and tasting and all those things. So I'm going to be learning a lot more about this. But anyway, that was my side mission.
Well, that's pretty awesome. Did you want to hear a random space fact?
Oh, man, that was a menacing one.
So anyway, so I often try to point out to people, whether it be the asteroid belt or space in general, that it's really, really empty. And we focus on the really cool stuff that we find that's not the emptiness, so at least most scientists do. But I found on Mike Brown's website, Mike Brown, the discoverer of Eris and various other objects in the outer solar system, as well as other things, that he had a nice image for this, which is if you take everything from the center of the solar system out to the Kuiper belt, it would be 99.999999% empty. If you had like a top-down map view. And 99% of that non-empty fraction is taken up by the sun. So just a whole lot of empty out there in space, which is why I always balk at asteroid fields and sci-fi movies.
I was literally just going to say that because there are some really wonderful, very accurate space games out there, but consistently they get the asteroid belts all wrong. Every time I see one, I'm like, why are all these objects so close together? Are they perhaps in a ring system that just shredded something?
Shred it.
I mean, I know it's more exciting to get to dodge around the asteroids, but that's just not how it is.
But that's how the games show it, so it must be true.
Yes, and extra nebulae for everyone.
Extra. And you get a nebula, and you get a nebulae. All right, are we done?
Yep.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about the inside of an orange. Is it dark in there? Thank you, and good night.
We've reached the end of this week's episode of Planetary Radio, but we'll be back next week with even more space science and exploration. If you love the show, you can get Planetary Radio t-shirts at planetary.org/shop, along with a lot of other cool spacey merchandise. Help others discover the passion, beauty, and joy of space science and exploration by leaving a review or a rating on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Your feedback not only brightens our day, but helps other curious minds find their place in space through Planetary Radio. You can also send us your space thoughts, questions, and poetry at our email at planetaryradio@planetary.org. Or if you're a Planetary Society member, leave a comment in the Planetary Radio space in our member community app. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by our members from all over the world. You can join us as we marvel at the weird and beautiful story of our solar system at planetary.org/join. Mark Hilverda and Ray Paoletta are our associate producers. Andrew Lucas is our audio editor. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. And until next week, Ad Astra.